This is Janice Schweizer returning with part two of the Pantograph for Tuesday, July 8, 2025. We begin on page A4 with the death notices. Martha Emily Lesher, age 85 of normal, passed away on Friday, July 4, 2025, at Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal, Illinois. Funeral services for Emily Lesher will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, July 11th, 2025 at Calvert and Metzler Memorial Home in Bloomington, Illinois. Visitation will take place at the funeral home prior to the service from 9:30 to 11 a.m. A private burial service will follow at Funk's Grove Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be made in Emily's honor to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, Ruby's Rescue and Retreat, or to the Salvation Army. Karen Sue Jordan, 83, of normal, passed away on Thursday, July 3, 2025, at Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal. Her visitation will begin at 9 o'clock a.m. Friday, July 11, 2025, at Carmody Flynn Funeral Home and will be followed by a service at 10 o'clock a.m. with the Reverend Ray Owens officiating. Burial will be in Park Hill Cemetery in Bloomington. Memorials may be directed to the American Cancer Society. Ellen J. Ashelman, 63, of Eureka, died Thursday, July 3, 2025, at Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal. Visitation will be Thursday, July 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Rustman Harris Funeral Home in El Paso, Illinois. Burial at Secor Cemetery will occur on a later date. Navy veteran James Robert Ensign, 83, passed away on Wednesday, July 2, 2025, at the Belle Trace Senior Living Facility in Bloomington, Indiana. There's no further information about a service or memorial contributions in this obituary. Donald Edward Heft, 94, of Bloomington, formerly of San Jose and Delavan, passed away on Friday, July 4, 2025, at Martin Health Center in Bloomington. He was a Navy veteran, and his funeral will be at 10 o'clock a.m. Thursday, July 10, 2025, at Davis Oswald Funeral Home in Delavan. Ernie Stone, spiritual coordinator at Westminster Village in Bloomington, will officiate. Visitation will be 1 hour before the service at the funeral home. Burial will be in Sand Prairie Cemetery in Green Valley. Memorials may be made to the American Stroke Association or to Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. Next, we'll turn to the sports page, where we have a commentary by Tom Johnston. Campbell is somebody we can all root for. Former Illinois standout wins classic in playoff. With the chants of ILLINI echoing across TPC Deer Run on Sunday, Brian Campbell stayed true to his blue-collar approach in the final round of the John Deere Classic. The former University of Illinois standout rode the wave of emotion to his second PGA Tour title this year, and in the process probably broke some hearts of golf fans here and around the world. Most eyes all week were on fellow Californians Max Homa and Ricky Fowler. While they may not have been betting favorites such as Ben Griffin, Sungjae Im, Jason Day, or JT Poston as the top-ranked players in the field, they were the fan favorites. Two of the most recognizable names in the 156-man field for the $8.4 million event drew much of the attention and did their best to remain relevant in quest of the title and $1.5 million winner's check. But in the end, it was a 32-year-old with a pasty complexion, Midwest values, and a humble approach who worked his way to the top and survived a one-hole playoff over Emiliano Grillo. Quote, "It means everything," unquote. "This is what I've worked my entire life to be in this position, and unfortunately we had a couple years there where it wasn't looking so good," close quote, said Campbell. Between demotions to the Corn Ferry Tour, illnesses and injuries, it has hardly been a smooth career for him. You have to start thinking about, am I going to do something else? Campbell said in his postmortem while talking about his career path. Maybe pro golf or this route is not going to work out. But it really was all second stage Q school about 2 or 3 years ago. I made like a quintuple bogey on a par three and thought my career was over in that moment. That night, just kind of had a self-talk with myself and said, you know what? Whatever happens is okay. Trust yourself. The next round, I went out there and shot 8 under and got myself right back in there. I guess I was like, maybe golf is not over for me. That moment was when everything changed. And now he is ready to carry the JDC banner for the next year. While many golf fans may not have known much about the former Illini standout for Coach Mike Small, he's a guy we can all get behind. He has a story that blue-collar Midwesterners should relate to, as he has a little bit of all of us in him. He won't be flashy like Fowler in his Sunday orange attire. He doesn't have Homa's personality. But he does have guts and heart, and those showed at Deer Run this week as he battled for the elements and the field for a tour title number 2. When he's firing on all cylinders, it's hard for many people to compete with him, said caddy Cooper Wilson. You know it's possible, but you don't really see yourself in this moment. To do it twice in 1 year is pretty remarkable. For him to do it at the JDC, where magic happens, is almost appropriate. To do it at Deer Run, where fellow Illini standout Steve Stricker won 3 straight titles from 2009 to 11, is kismet. Magic does happen at the John Deere, said Campbell. Man, I just can't think of all the shots. I mean, Spieth's hole out from the bunker, Stricker's impossible four iron from the bunker to win for his 3rd time. I played with Zach Johnson Thursday and Friday, and it was awesome to talk about some of his shots he's had here. What a great guy. So thrilled to be here. They put on such an amazing tournament here, and thanks. Campbell, who opened the week at number 59 in the FedEx Cup standings, jumped to number 28 with the victory. That would be good enough to make the tour championship if he plays well enough in the playoffs. I'll be rooting for him after this victory, and you should too. Looking at NASCAR now, we have Van Gisbergen makes history at Chicago Street Race, only the 2nd driver to complete the weekend sweep, by Jay Cohen. Shane Van Gisbergen burned out his tires in celebration, sending white smoke into the air. He signed a rugby ball and punted it into the stands in downtown Chicago. It was a familiar scene. Van Gisbergen completed a Windy City sweep Sunday, winning the NASCAR Cup Series race on the tricky street course in downtown Chicago. Epic weekend for us. I'm a lucky guy, he said. A talented one, too. The 36-year-old New Zealand native became the 2nd driver to sweep the Xfinity and Cup races in a single weekend from the pole, joining Kyle Busch at Indianapolis in 2016. With his 3rd career Cup win, he also became the winningest foreign-born driver on NASCAR's top series. It was Van Gisbergen's 2nd victory of the season after the Trackhouse Racing driver also won last month on a Mexico City road course. He's the best road course stock car racer I've ever seen, Trackhouse owner Justin Marks said. I think when he's done with us all and walks away from the sport, I think he's going to walk away as the best road course racer that this sport has ever seen. Marks brought Van Gisbergen over from Australia's Supercars for the 1st edition of NASCAR's Chicago Experiment in 2023, and he became the 1st driver to win his Cup debut since Johnny Rutherford in the 2nd qualifying race at Daytona in 1963. He also won Chicago's Xfinity Series stop last year and the 1st stage in the Cup race before he was knocked out by a crash. This joint, it's changed my life, Van Gisbergen said. I didn't have any plans to do more NASCAR races when I first came over here, and I never thought I'd be in NASCAR full time. In what might be the last NASCAR race on the downtown Chicago circuit, Ty Gibbs was 2nd and Tyler Reddick finished 3rd. Denny Hamlin and Kyle Busch rounded out the top 5. My team called a great strategy and got me in position to get me up front to compete for the win, Gibbs said. It worked out for us today, so I'm glad to have a good finish, but we wish we could have gone for the win. Michael McDowell joined Van Gisbergen on the front row and quickly moved in front. He won stage one and led for 31 laps before he was derailed by a throttle cable issue. Van Gisbergen regained the lead when he passed Chase Briscoe with 16 laps left. As fog and rain moved into downtown Chicago, Van Gisbergen controlled the action the rest of the way. A.J. Allmendinger was 6th and Ryan Preece finished 7th. Ryan Blaney, who won the second stage, was 12th. I thought overall it was a pretty decent day. It was nice to win that stage, Blaney said. William Byron's day was cut short by a clutch problem. The Hendricks Motorsports driver leads the point standings by 13 points over Chase Elliott. After McDowell seized the lead early in the race, Carson Hovcar caused a multi-car crash when he hit the wall and spun out between turns 10 and 11. Brad Keselowski, Austin Dillon, Daniel Suarez, and Will Brown were among the drivers collected in the wreck. I didn't see it until the last second, Keselowski said. I slowed down and I actually felt I was going to get stopped, and then I just kind of got ran over from behind. It's just a narrow street course and sometimes there's nowhere to go. Ty Dillon and Reddick moved into the third round of NASCAR's inaugural in-season tournament when Keselowski and Hovcar were unable to finish the race. Dillon, the number 32 seed, eliminated Keselowski after he upset top-seeded Denny Hamlin last weekend at Atlanta. Gibbs, Preece, Alex Bowman, John C. Nemechek, Zane Smith, and Eric Jones also advanced. The winner of the five-race bracket-style tournament takes home a $1 million prize. Bowman, the 2024 champion on the downtown street course, won his head-to-head matchup with Bubba Wallace. Bowman and Wallace made contact as they battled for position late in the race, after they also tangled in Chicago last year. I wasn't expecting that to happen or to get raced like that, but we did, Bowman said. We just have to move on from it and keep digging. I don't really know what I could have done much different. Looking again at national news, we have Trump pushes for deals as tariffs loom by Ellen Nickmeyer and Michelle L. Price with the AP. The Trump administration stepped up pressure on trading partners to quickly make new deals before a Wednesday deadline, with plans for the U.S. to start sending letters on Monday warning countries that higher tariffs could kick in on August 1st. That furthers the uncertainty for businesses, consumers, and America's trading partners, and questions remain about which countries will be notified, whether anything will change in the days ahead, and whether President Donald Trump will once more push off imposing the rates. Trump and his top trade advisors say he could extend the time for dealmaking, but they insist the administration is applying maximum pressure on other nations. Stephen Miran, the chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisers, likewise said countries negotiating in good faith and making concessions could sort of get the date rolled. The steeper tariffs that Trump announced April 2nd threatened to overhaul the global economy and lead to broader trade wars. A week later, after the financial markets had panicked, his administration suspended for 90 days most of the higher taxes on imports, just as they were to take effect. The negotiating window until July 9th led to announced deals only with the United Kingdom and Vietnam. Trump imposed elevated tariff rates on dozens of nations that run meaningful trade surpluses with the U.S. and a 10% baseline tax on imports from all countries in response to what he called an economic emergency. There are separate 50% tariffs on steel and aluminum and a 25% tariff on autos. Since April, few foreign governments set new trade terms with Washington as the Republican president demanded. Trump told reporters on Friday his administration might send out letters as early as Saturday to countries spelling out their tariff rates if they did not reach a deal, but that the U.S. would not start collecting those taxes until August 1st. On Sunday, he said he would send letters starting Monday, could be 12, could be 15, to foreign governments reflecting planned tariffs for each. "We've made deals also," Trump told reporters before heading back to the White House from his home in New Jersey. "So we'll get to have a combination of letters and some deals have been made." He and his advisors declined to say which countries would receive the letters. The Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, rejected the idea that August 1 was a new deadline and declined to say what might happen Wednesday. "We'll see," Bessent said on CNN's State of the Union. "I'm not going to give away the playbook." Later Sunday, Trump vowed to impose more tariffs against the BRICS bloc of developing nations, which condemned tariff increases at its summit in Brazil. Trump said in a post on his social media platform that any country aligning itself with what he termed the anti-American policies of BRICS would be levied an added 10% tariff. Trump announced a deal with Vietnam that would allow U.S. goods to enter the country duty-free, while Vietnamese exports to the U.S. would face a 20% levy. That was a decline from the 46% tax on Vietnamese imports he proposed in April, one of his so-called reciprocal tariffs targeting dozens of countries with which the U.S. runs a trade deficit. Asked if he expected to reach deals with the European Union or India, Trump said Friday that letters are better for us because there are so many countries involved. "We have India coming up, and with Vietnam we did it, but much easier to send a letter saying, listen, we know we have a certain deficit, or in some cases a surplus, but not too many, and this is what you're going to have to pay if you want to do business in the U.S. Canada, however, will not receive a letter. Trump's ambassador, Pete Hoekstra, said Friday after trade talks between the two countries recently resumed. "Canada is one of our biggest trading partners," Hoekstra told CTV News in an interview in Ottawa. "We're going to have a deal that's articulated." Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney has said he wants a new deal in place by July 21st, or Canada will increase trade countermeasures. Hoekstra would not commit to a date for a trade agreement and said even with a deal, Canada could still face some tariffs. "But we're not going to send Canada just a letter," he said. From Wendy Lee of the LA Times, we have NASA's Next Frontier, a Netflix streaming deal. Netflix is already home to popular dramas like Squid Game, movies, and live boxing matches. The next frontier for the streamer, live rocket launches from NASA. The streaming giant is teaming up with the agency to bring space into viewers' living rooms, including with views of Earth from the International Space Station to its vast content offering as the company treks further into the realm of live TV. Financial terms of the deal were not disclosed. Content from streaming service NASA Plus, which includes rocket launches, astronaut spacewalks, and mission coverage, will be coming to the Los Gatos, California-based streaming service this summer. The National Aeronautics and Our Space Act of 1958 calls on us to share our story of space exploration with the broadest possible audience, said Rebecca Sermons, general manager of NASA Plus, in a statement. "Together, we're committing to a golden age of innovation and exploration, inspiring new generations right from the comfort of their couch or in the palm of their hand from their phone." The content could fit in with the streamer's other educational content, including documentaries and programs targeting families, including Sesame Street and Miss Rachel. Children's programming has been a growth area for Netflix as it encroaches on the traditional broadcaster's turf. Netflix last year said it had more than 301 million subscribers. On Monday, the streamer said its audience encompasses more than 700 million people. NASA Plus continues to be available for free on its website and on the NASA app. Space-related nonfiction programming has long history for film and television viewers, whether through IMAX museum documentaries and public broadcasting's storied Nova franchise. Next, we have Netanyahu, Trump, take victory lap. Israeli Prime Minister plans to nominate U.S. President for Nobel Peace Prize by Tia Goldenberg and Michelle Price. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told President Donald Trump that he was nominating the U.S. leader for a Nobel Peace Prize as the two took a victory lap Monday after their recent joint strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities, with both hailing the 12-day war as an unmitigated success. The two leaders sat down with their top aides for a dinner in the White House Blue Room to mark the operation and discuss efforts to push forward with the 60-day ceasefire proposal to pause the conflict in Gaza. "He's forging peace as we speak, in one country and one region after another," said Netanyahu as he presented Trump with a nominating letter he said he is sending to the Nobel Committee. But as Netanyahu arrived at the White House for his third visit this year, the outwardly triumphant visit was dogged by Israel's 21-month war against Hamas in Gaza and questions over how hard Trump will push for an end to the conflict. But in an exchange before reporters, before the dinner got underway, both leaders expressed optimism that their success would mark a new era in the Middle East. "I think things are going to be really settled down a lot in the Middle East," Trump said, "and they respect us and they respect Israel." Trump has made clear that following last month's 12-day war between Israel and Iran, he would like to see the Gaza conflict end soon. The meeting between Trump and Netanyahu may give new urgency to a U.S. ceasefire proposal being discussed by Israel and Hamas, but whether it leads to a deal that ends the war is unclear. The utmost priority for the president right now in the Middle East is to end the war in Gaza and return all of the hostages, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told reporters ahead of the leaders' private dinner. Before departing for Washington on Sunday, Netanyahu praised the cooperation with the U.S. for bringing a huge victory over our shared enemy. He struck a positive note on a ceasefire for Gaza, saying he was working to achieve the deal under discussion on the terms we agreed to. Netanyahu is slated to meet Tuesday with Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson. And in a photograph accompanying this article, we have protesters are demonstrating in Lafayette Square during the Netanyahu's visit, and they are authentic rabbis carrying signs that say the Torah demands all Palestine is to be returned to Palestinian sovereignty. The AP reports doctors' health groups sue over policy change. COVID-19 vaccine guidelines revised for kids and pregnant women. A coalition of doctors' groups and public health organizations sued the U.S. government on Monday over the decision to stop recommending COVID-19 vaccines for most children and pregnant women. The American Academy of Pediatrics, American Public Health Association, and four other groups, along with an unnamed pregnant doctor who works in a hospital, filed the lawsuit in federal court in Boston. The U.S. health officials, following infectious disease experts' guidance, previously urged annual COVID-19 shots for all Americans ages 6 months and older. But in late May, Health Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. announced he removed COVID-19 shots from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's recommendations for healthy children and pregnant women. A number of health experts decried the move as confusing and accused Kennedy of disregarding the scientific review process that has been in place for decades, in which experts publicly review medical evidence and hash out the pros and cons of policy changes. HHS officials did not respond to a request for a comment. And in the digest, we have the U.S. government will initiate deportation proceedings against Kilmar Abrego Garcia if he's released from jail before he stands trial on human smuggling charges in Tennessee, a Justice Department attorney told a federal judge in Maryland on Monday. The disclosure by U.S. lawyer Jonathan Goin contradicts statements by spokespeople for the Justice Department and the White House, who said last month that Abrego Garcia would stand trial and possibly spend time in an American prison before the government moves to deport him. Gwynn made the revelation during a federal court hearing in Maryland, where Abrego Garcia's American wife is suing the Trump administration over his wrongful deportation in March. A heavily armed man opened fire on federal agents with an assault rifle Monday morning at a U.S. Border Patrol facility in Texas, injuring a police officer before authorities shot and killed him. Authorities identified the man as Ryan Lewis Mosqueda, who they said fired dozens of rounds at agents and the building in McAllen, which is near the U.S.-Mexico border. McAllen Police Chief Victor Rodriguez said Mosqueda was carrying a utility vest in addition to the rifle when federal agents returned fire. After Mosqueda was killed, law enforcement found other weaponry, ammunition, and backpacks that the suspect had brought to the scene. The Trump administration plans to end the temporary protected status for nearly 80,000 Hondurans and Nicaraguans that allowed them to live and work in the U.S. for 25 years, according to a federal government notice that will become official today. Federal officers and National Guard troops fanned out around a mostly empty Los Angeles park in a largely immigrant neighborhood on foot, horseback, and in military vehicles Monday for about an hour before abruptly leaving, an operation that local officials said seemed designed to sow fear. Federal officials had no comment. A Liberian-flagged cargo ship came under fire Monday in the Red Sea, with two security guards on board reportedly hurt and two others missing in an assault that came after Yemen's Houthi rebels purportedly sunk another vessel in a similar attack. President Donald Trump said Monday the U.S. will send more weapons to Ukraine, days after he ordered a pause in weapons deliveries. Trump's comments appeared to be an abrupt change in posture after the Pentagon announced last week they would hold back delivering more weapons to Ukraine. A woman was killed when floodwaters from the remnants of Tropical Storm Chantal swept her car from a rural road and forced dozens of people to flee their homes, officials in North Carolina said on Monday. Parts of central North Carolina experienced hazardous conditions overnight, including 3 to 8 inches of rain and possible tornadoes. And in Syria, the Trump administration revoked the terrorism designation of a group led by Syria's new president Monday as part of a broader U.S. engagement with the transitional government since the ouster of former leader Bashar Assad late last year. And today's flick fact. The late, great actor Patrick Swayze, perhaps most notably remembered for his dancing in the 1987 hit movie Dirty Dancing, 4 years prior, in 1983, was on a real-life dance floor in Bloomington. It was while he was in the area filming a movie, Grandview, USA, being shot in Pontiac, also starring Jamie Lee Curtis. Do you know where Swayze was dancing that night in Bloomington? Well, it was at a trendy, very popular, hormones-flying night spot called Smuggler's Inn. Since torn down, it's where today is a Noodles & Company, Jersey Mike's, and Chipotle, across the street from State Farm's corporate offices. And with that, we conclude the reading of the Pantograph for Tuesday, July 8, 2025. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I hope you have a great day.